Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 171 of Registry Matters. Larry, we've definitely surpassed your age by now.
We're almost, but we still got two more years to go.
A person in chat says that she is 160, so you guys are sort of like contemporaries, maybe?
Oh, I'd say we're very close in age.
I mean, once you get that far, what's a difference of 10 or 20 years at that point? You basically like went to the single little schoolhouse together. You ran down the hill together?
It was uphill.
Both ways in the snow?
Both ways, yes.
Anything exciting that happened to you during the week, or do you want to dive right in?
Well, I can't think of anything terribly exciting that the audience would find amusing or entertaining.
Well, then maybe we should dive right in. And before we go on, Larry, be sure that you like and subscribe and share on YouTube, and also write a review on your podcast app of choice and all those other great things to help spread the word to all the peoples that we exist. What do we have going on tonight, Larry?
If you don't hit that like button on YouTube, every YouTube viewer, we're going to disconnect you from this end.
Perfect. We can do that too. I have the technology.
Oh, yeah, we didn't get very many likes last week, but we didn't get any dislikes either.
Well, that's good.
So
you didn't say anything that anybody was really that offended by.
So tonight we're going to hear a voicemail and try to address that, and we're going to have some letter questions that were submitted in writing, and we're going to read a letter, and then we're going to talk about two cases, from one from the U.S. Supreme Court and one from the Minnesota Supreme Court.
Excellent. All right.
We may end up dropping the articles that we were contemplating because these cases are going to devour some time.
Yeah, I thought we had already kicked them out, but we do have one that we're keeping because one of our loyal listeners submitted. It actually looks kind of interesting to talk about. All right, well then let's dive right in. I think he might be patron number one, an individual from Kentucky named Jeff, and he sent a voicemail message.
Happy Saturday to my two favorite podcasters, Andy and Larry. I had a question about a court case that Larry has touched on in the past. It's called the Commonwealth of Kentucky versus Baker, and it says, the question of law to be answered is whether or not KRS 17.545, which restricts where registered offenders may live, may be applied to those who committed their offenses prior to July 12, 2006, and the effective date of the statute. We hold that it may not. So when Larry touched on this before, I thought he said that they could not force you to leave your house if a park or daycare or school popped up. Well, I'm reading that they can't force you to do that unless your crime was committed after 2009. I was wondering if Larry would review the case and give me some insight on what the case actually says. And as always, FYP. Have a great day, guys. Thanks.
Thank you, Jeff, very much. I seem to recall this going on way back in the day. This may have been pre-podcast that this was even talked about.
It may have been. We've talked about it, certainly, and written about it. When I say we, meaning Narsil. And the question he asked is actually a good one. And we don't know the answer for sure. I didn't thoroughly reread the case, but I remember it fairly well. And, of course, courts can't, they're not clairvoyant. They cannot foresee the future. So the issue before them in that case was for that block of offenders that predated the registration statute that was in question, those prohibitions. It would be my non-legal opinion that the same concerns that they held when they issued that opinion 15 years ago would hold true today. What they were trying to address was the perpetual vulnerability to being asked to move, that there would be no place, there'd be no offender would be safe. And that would not have changed since then in terms of if you could force a person to move. then you would not be safe. So if you were convicted after 2009, I believe he said, then you would not be safe. That makes no more sense than what it made in 2006, none whatsoever. But as we said before, guess what? If they have passed a law that says you have to move, you remember where the presumption is, right?
The presumption is that you if you were convicted before, if you didn't have to do it, then you wouldn't have to do it now.
But the presumption of constitutionality, if the
legislature it's presumed constitutional when the legislature signs it and the governor signs it, then it's presumed to be constitutional until it's said otherwise by a court.
So there, since this this case that he's mentioning, the Baker case, didn't apply to people after 2009, there would have to be a new challenge if they have started forcing people retroactively to leave their homes. I have heard nothing about that in all the years since this case was decided that that's happening or occurring or even contemplated in Kentucky. But if they are doing that, they would be able to do it until they're stopped.
I've heard that before, Larry. I've heard that they can do it until they're told to stop.
And sometimes they don't stop after being told.
I've heard of that too. It's kind of an amazing thing. Are we ready to go on and start delving into this content?
If there's anything going on that we need to know about in Kentucky, from Jeff, I'd be glad to hear about it, and we can take it up in our next episode. But I'm not aware of anything in terms of people being forced to move.
All right. And then, all right. So we received a letter from a woman that says, hello, I'd like to receive more info on your organization, please. I'm currently a female PFR from 26 years ago. And it's not even that I'm a pedophile. It's registration that's ruining my life. I received only 5 years after I refused the offer plea for original charge itself. They tried to give me 10 years for a missed registration appointment. 26 years later, I managed to talk them down to 4. It is ruining my whole life. Please give me info that will help. Sincerely. Jeez, did she receive more time for a failure to register than she did for the original offense, whatever that was?
Sounds that way. And unfortunately, I cannot give her any good news because all the challenges in Texas, this letter comes from Gatesville, Texas, all the challenges in Texas have been turned aside because the proof has not been satisfactory that the registry is imposing enough disabilities or restraints. They have not been able to distinguish the registry requirements in Texas to the level. And in fact, a lot of the restrictions don't occur in Texas. It's these other states have had that have made their schemes vulnerable. And so therefore, she's in that tragic land of, in the intervening years, the penalty for the civil regulatory scheme is greater than what the penalty was for the crime. And she's having to bargain for a sentence that's greater than what originally was imposed. And she's going to continue to experience this potential for prosecution because registration is basically lifetime in Texas. Very few people are removed through that process that they do have on the books, but no one actually achieves removal.
It's one of those that you'd have to find the tiniest little scope where you were convicted for these 3 days, 27 years ago, and then you might be able to get off something ridiculous like that.
Yes, and it's going to be, in my prediction, very similar with California. I can't wait to start hearing the statistics as they come out of California. But the process, the way it's designed on paper, it's going to be a very difficult thing for anyone to achieve a deregistration in California. But I'm hoping I'm wrong.
Yeah. Well, that's discouraging for sure. And certainly sorry to hear that. Are we able to send her any information that might be of help?
Well, we're gonna get her on the NARSL newsletter list. I'm always glad to hear from new institutions, so we sometimes sprinkle a new institution with newsletters. And so now this is the first communication we've had from that prison, and we're also gonna give her a trial run for the podcast transcript. So hopefully that is some consolation. She can at least collect information about what's going on through the NARSL newsletter and from us.
Larry, tell me real quick, why don't we just blanket every prison in the United States and send letters out?
It's an undertaking, I'll tell you.
It was totally just like a bait and switch kind of question for you, just to
just make your head kind of explode, because there's 2.5 million people in prison, and we would, like, there's got to be, I don't know, maybe an average of 1,000 people per prison, maybe. That would be a lot of letters going out.
Some prisons have far more than 1,000.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. But some only have a few hundred, too. All right. Then we'll move on to this question that we received. It says, Dear Andy and Larry, glad to make your acquaintance, but of course, not under these circumstances. And I think, well, did you want me to read that in one next paragraph, or was that it?
No, we just wanted, no, this is a tragic letter from a guy in Alabama who was traveling, and he ended up getting pulled over by the police, and we speculated about what might have happened. And from his letter, that's far too long to read on the podcast, it looks like a lot of our speculation was correct in terms of how it went down the stop and what happened. And he's wanting appellate help, and Alabama is probably not going to be a state that provides anything in the way of post-conviction resources beyond what they're absolutely required to do. So I don't know that we can be of any more help to him other than say, we feel bad for you. We did get the letter. And at the moment, I don't have anything to offer him other than condolences.
Well, all right, then. Then we will move on. Man, Larry, at this pace, we'll be done with the podcast in about 20 minutes. Then we've received another letter. It says, to whomever this may concern, hello, my name is McLean, and I have been wrongly convicted of rape and sexual assault and sentenced to 33 years. God, that's a long time, Larry. There's no DA, no rape kits, no physical evidence, blah, 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 blah. No evidence. The prosecutor allowed a bunch of known false testimony to go uncorrected, and that the state deleted and withheld evidence that would have proven my innocence, .. what did you want to say about this?
I feel bad for him, but we're trying to use this as an educational moment for people. When he says up above, there's no DNA, no rape kits, no physical evidence whatsoever, the state relied heavily on their witness testimony. Well, that's what's permitted in our system. There's no requirement anywhere, constitutional or otherwise, that there be forensic evidence. If you look back on the founding of the Republic, we didn't have anything that resembled rape kits or DNA,
sure,
or forensics analysis in those days. And we relied for convictions on mostly people being seen and observed by others of what they were being accused of. And the courts and the juries evaluated the credibility of those individuals. In the arena of sexual offenses, the courts have been mandated by legislation to make it very difficult for you to challenge anything that the accuser says, because the accuser is being re-victimized. Right. If you actually confront them. It's the only crime I can think of where that is the standard. In every other crime, yeah. if you claim you're embezzled, that you've lost a bunch of money, the first thing that they demand of you is evidence that you had anything to start with.
Sure.
You have to come up with journals and videotape or nobody uses tape anymore, but video clips of something that identifies that a crime actually occurred. But in the case of this offense, the statutes have been largely amended to where no such evidence. In fact, it's been more sinister than that. They've put in the statutes that no other evidence is required. So that gets to be read to the jury that no other evidence is required. So when he says there's no evidence, there was evidence. There was evidence of the testimony.
Yeah, it wasn't physical. Yeah. Brenda asks, what do we know about the known false claims that he makes? I mean, how would you prove that the prosecutor knew that they were false testimony?
Well, that's a good question. And what happens is that if you've ever talked to your defense attorney, if you tell them what you did, they will tell you, I cannot allow you to get on the stand and say anything contradictory to that. You've heard that before, okay, right?
I believe so, yeah.
You've heard. Well, the prosecutors, they do no such admonishment. They know that police officers get on the stand and they tell exaggerated truths all the time. And sometimes they tell incredulous stories and versions of stuff. But he has to prove, the burden as a convicted person now, he has to prove that they withheld evidence. He has to uncover the withheld evidence and show that it would have altered the outcome. There may be evidence that's withheld that would have changed the outcome, and people get obsessed over that. So he's got to first prove that there's evidence that would have been exculpatory, that would have been relevant, and that the prosecutor withheld it, that they had it at that time, and the false testimony. That's going to be a tough one. Is he going to be able to get people to admit that they committed perjury? And that never goes anywhere either. Because
I can't imagine anybody would admit to it. Yeah, because those people in some kind of prison, hot water.
Well, but not only that, when you admit that you gave false testimony, then you are an admitted liar.
Correct.
And at that point, the question turns on you. And they say, okay, so you're an admitted liar, correct?
Yeah, I am.
And you say, no, I'm not. They say, well, wait a minute. You're telling a different story today than what you told on the witness stand 2.5 years ago. So yeah. Since both stories cannot be true, which one is true? Well, of course, the answer is the one I'm saying today. And then they say, but you're an admitted liar. So why should we believe anything that you said? How can we put any faith in your testimony? That's the way it goes down.
So I want to back up. Go. I'll ask you my question in a second.
So on false testimony, that's going to be a really tough one. And he's in the position. He's going to have to prove that there's perjured or false testimony.
Okay. But when you go to court the first time, the burden of proof is on the prosecutor. And you're saying that when you try to, I guess your expression is take a second bite at the apple. If you try and go back, you have the burden of proof to prove these allegations of misconduct and whatnot?
Because you're now the convicted person.
And so for you to get something reversed, overturned, you have to then prove that the prosecutor lied, that the evidence was prosecutorial misconduct, the evidence was not legit and all that stuff. You have to go prove that. That's a pretty high hurdle to cross too.
Yeah, it's very, very high. Now, if you can prove that there was relevant exculpatory evidence that the prosecution had at the time and that they didn't, that'll get you a long ways. If he can show that, but he's got to show what the evidence was and how it was relevant. I mean, you can come up with anything that you can imagine that people say, well, my lawyer could have done this, they could have done that. Well, they could have done a lot of things, but he's saying that there's withheld evidence. What evidence was withheld? He can write us back and tell us that because he'll get the transcript. What evidence was withheld in particular, and how would it have altered the outcome?
I guess I've heard from miscellaneous court transcriptions that yes, there was something of withheld or prosecutorial misconduct, but it wouldn't have changed the outcome. So somebody has to then go make that decision that yes, it wasn't 2 p.m. it was 7 p.m. but that wouldn't have changed the outcome of the case.
That is correct. And a misspeak in testimony doesn't constitute perjury, or would it change the outcome? Okay. There may be like a surveillance log was withheld. They had you under surveillance, and they withheld the surveillance log, and it would prove that you were at a certain place at a certain time, and you couldn't have committed the murder. Now that would be a piece of relevant information. That could potentially change the outcome. If governmental agents had you under surveillance, and they found you. And that was withheld by the prosecution because it would have sunk their case. But if the surveillance log revealed nothing other than you drank yourself to a stupor 10 minutes before the crime occurred, I mean, that would not change the outcome. So that surveillance log withheld would not be nearly as relevant at that. But he really needs good legal advice to take this evidence to and find out if he has any hope, because how post-conviction works in Ohio, we wouldn't have any idea, and that's where this letter originates from. We wouldn't have any idea about all that stuff, and we couldn't give the advice even if we did.
Okay. Well, all right, then let's move along. So it goes, hello, I was wondering if you could possibly help me out. I am going to parole from Illinois Department of Corrections to the state of Arkansas. I'm going to go live with my mom and her boyfriend. I would like to know if you people would be so kind as to send me all of any of the PFR laws and the registration laws for Arkansas.
Wow, that would be when he says all the laws, I guess he means
I know all of it.
Every sexual offense. Well, that's not feasible to do. Now, I'm hoping the day comes when we can actually ascend the statutory schemes, which can be 20, 30, 40, 50 pages of stuff. What's I find interesting is when we send those, when I'm in a good mood and I actually send someone the registration, the entire registration statute,
okay,
they write back and say they had no idea that there was this much to it. You know, that was 44 pages okay. or whatever.
Yeah, they thought probably it was just like five bullet points or something.
So, in terms of his, we don't know enough about, or at least I don't know enough. I don't know about you. I don't know enough about getting released from the Illinois Department of Corrections. What we do know is that there's a lot of litigation for people being held in who are eligible for what they call mandatory supervised release. Their MSR, the Prison Review Board, and the has to approve their housing, and they never approve the places because of some proximity restriction. So people stay in Illinois Department of Corrections way beyond their date. We know that. But when he goes to Arkansas, if he's able to make that connection to Arkansas, if Illinois first will allow him the opportunity to apply, and if Arkansas accepts him, if his proposed residence doesn't violate one of their restrictions, if he manages to get to Arkansas, in some regards, it would be better. The registry is better in Arkansas as it exists right now. I think their legislature is in session right now. I don't know at the end of the session if it'll change, because they've been trying for a few years to change their risk-based system that they have. But in that regard, after 15 years, he could file a petition to be removed, assuming in the next 15 years the law doesn't change. I don't believe that process exists in Illinois. So he would be better off. He would be under Arkansas's registration. In terms of the supervision, I don't think it's going to get much better in Arkansas. I think it's going to be very similar, because they're obligated to follow everything that Illinois has. Plus, they're allowed to put conditions consistent with how they supervise PFRs in Arkansas. So he's going to bring every condition of his supervision from Illinois with him, and he's going to pick up whatever they impose, if anything additional.
Jen just added a little anecdote. Says that they passed two horrible hate laws in Arkansas this week, which without any details, I don't know what they did. But Brenda also points out that maybe this individual's family could go check out the NARSAL wiki, and that would be the Cliff Notes version of the statute for the two states.
So that would be a good idea. And then I want to just make one other observation, and very few people choose where they're born, and we're not reading the second paragraph or the third paragraph, but he says that he was charged with a sexual abuse victim 13 to 17, and he was 16 and she was 13, and then he was 19 and she was 17. If you lived in a civilized state like mine, neither one of those would have been a crime, as long as it was consensual. Because we do not prosecute 16-year-olds for having consensual sex with a 13-year-old. And we do not prosecute 19-year-olds for having consensual sex with a 17-year-old. Now, that's all contingent. It had to be consensual. But
of course,
we've got a 4-year age bracket. So 19 is less than 4 different from 17. So no prosecution on that. And 16 to 13, there's a less than 4 years, and they're both juveniles. We don't prosecute that. So if you had your parents choose New Mexico or what, you wouldn't be in this position, because we don't do that here. So, but unfortunately, he's got failures to report, and I think that's going to change the alteration on my previous comment about him getting a discharge in Arkansas. They're going to be really reluctant to let him off registry, even if the law doesn't change in the next 15 years, because he's got failures to register. And if I'm the prosecuting attorney in whatever county he chooses to live in, Arkansas, the first thing I'm going to say is that this person's had difficulty complying with registration. Judge, we can't let him off. That's what I would say. If I can think of that, trust me, they can think of that.
All right. Let's do at least one article. And this one came, by the way, of one of our longtime listeners and patrons. And it says, former Missoula man sues over outdated sodomy law convictions, sex offender requirement. And this comes from KPVI, wherever that is. I don't know what that is. I guess it's Missoula, which is Montana. But you wanted to highlight one particular paragraph, if I can find it. It says, however, oh wait, nope, not that however. However, no, not that however. There's another however. I think I went too far, Larry. You know what's, this is the trouble of doing. Oh, there it is. However, in 2005, the Montana State Legislature changed the law so that anyone required to register as a PFR in one state had to register as an offender in Montana. And Idaho, unlike Montana, still has a law against sodomy and oral sex and requires people convicted of crimes to register as PFRs under its Crimes Against Nature statute. That doesn't really comport with what I understand a crime against nature, but that's just how I understand it.
Well, I feel bad about this because the person could end up with a very textual interpretation like we've talked about out of Nebraska when the person moved from Colorado and they had very similar language in their statute. Now, that was a state court. That was a state decision. And the person was charged with violating the registry. Is this person being charged with violating the registry or did he file a declaratory judgment action? Is it clear in the article? Because I just did a skim read of the article.
Yeah, I didn't read much about it either, so I can't answer that myself.
So, well, if he filed a declaratory action, it will permit him to bring forth the evidence that would not be necessarily opportunity for if he's being prosecuted in a criminal case. Some people just insist on using the wrong vehicle. But it just says it right here. He filed it. He's in federal court in a 1983 action. So he's doing the correct thing. He's filing a petition. He may get a different outcome in federal court because the federal court first is bound to follow the state law. But if he can put forth some constitutional claim about equal protection, he might can prevail. But if he were to take this, if he had taken this into state court, which is probably why he didn't file his declaratory action in state court, he would likely end up with a similar decision that came out of the Nebraska Supreme Court. They're going to ask him, "You are a person, right?" Well, yes. Yeah, you did. You do have to register in your state of Idaho, correct? Yes. Well, it's black letter law. It says right there that you're covered under Montana's law. If you've got a problem, that goes to the legislature. That's what a textual interpretation would be. If you look at very issue in Nebraska where the issue was whether juveniles would have to register, Judge Koff, a federal judge, was trying his best not to register, require those people to register, and he was inventing the intent. He was putting some of that intent into the decision because he says, well, we don't register Nebraskans that are convicted as minors. Therefore, it stands to reason that the legislature didn't intend to register juveniles from out of state. But the Nebraska Supreme Court said, nope, they could have said that. They could have said any person other than a juvenile who was convicted out of state. They didn't say that. And our robes do not entitle us to insert that into the statute. Well, that federal judge has the same robe. He's not entitled to insert that into the statute unless you can prove there's a constitutional violation occurring that he cannot apply that law if he can enjoin the state of Montana from applying that law to you. But you're on an uphill climb because the law says what it says it does. And most people, when they say they're for a textual interpretation, you're covered.
Charles comments, but he is registering in Montana for a crime from Idaho that wouldn't be a crime in Montana. Does it matter?
Doesn't matter.
Okay.
It's a civil regulatory scheme. He's not being charged with a crime.
Of course, of course. Civil regulatory
scheme. He has the requisite definition that subjects him to the scope of the regulatory scheme. And I mean, that's an argument he can make, and I'm sure he will make it. He will say that would be a crime here, but that's not going to be the analysis. If it's a textual judge, the textual judge is going to say, well, let me ask you again. Are you a person? Yes. Did you move here from Idaho? Yes. Did you have to register in Idaho? Yes. Okay. Where's your beef?
And just as a final note, the ACLU is assisting him.
That is amazing. That's really amazing. They generally don't get involved in these things.
Are you ready to move on to the main event? Ding, 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 ding.
Do we have a main event tonight?
Well, I mean, I guess these two cases that you put in here are the main event.
Wow. We're going to talk about cases tonight? What did you put in here?
I know, right? So, yeah, you people put in a couple. One is Torres versus Madrid. We're going to sue the whole country of Madrid, or the city. What's the city? I guess it's Spain, Madrid. That was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court on March 25th. The other is called Minnesota versus Frankios Momolu. I'm totally botching these words up, which was decided in Minnesota Supreme Court. I glanced, Larry, I didn't read. I glanced, and I can't really see the relevance of the case, and I'm really struggling with the other one. So what are we going to do with these?
Which one can you not see the relevance to?
Either. How about that? So which one do you want to cover first?
So, well, they're both relevant, but the one that's going to take up the most time is the Minnesota one. So let's do it first.
Cool. Then, according to the court's opinion, a female referred to as JS was intoxicated after drinking alcohol and taking a prescription narcotic. She went to a bar with a friend, but was denied entry due to her intoxication. The appellant, Mr. Khalil, approached JS outside of the bar and invited her to accompany him to a supposed party at a house. Like, that story's never been played in a movie and it went south before. After arriving at the house, JS passed out and woke up to find Khalil penetrating her vagina with his penis. Since we all know that the accusers don't lie, it sure seems like rape to me. And why is this here in the program for tonight?
Well, it's not quite that easy. As the court noted, the question is whether Khalil's conduct is third-degree criminal sexual conduct under Minnesota law. And under Minnesota law, that is the sexual penetration with another person when the perpetrator knows or has reason to know that the complainant is mentally incapacitated.
I gotcha. Yeah, and you and your super focus on nuances in laws. Everyone knows that if a person is intoxicated, that they are mentally incapacitated. But God, Larry, that would be squishy, because how intoxicated are you?
Well, I'm not so sure that we can agree on that. As the court pointed out, the decision turns onto the meaning of the mentally incapacitated as defined in Minnesota statute. And you guys need to look up Minnesota statute 609.341. The statute provides mentally incapacitated means that a person under the influence of alcohol, a narcotic, anesthetic, or any other substance administered to that person without the person's agreement lacks the judgment to give reasoned consent to sexual contact or sexual penetration. Specifically, the court was tasked to determine whether the phrase administered to that person without the person's agreement applies to alcohol. In other words, the court had to decide whether a person can be mentally incapacitated under the statute when the person voluntarily ingests alcohol. That's what this is about.
Because didn't we say before that she took the narcotic on her own, correct? Didn't we say that at the top?
Yep.
Then I'm confused on why there's even a question. All right. The court seems to be out of touch with the reality of rape. How is it that they can simply turn a rapist loose on some ridiculous technicality? Let me share some of the facts from the decision, which parties do not dispute. JS, she traveled with her friend SL to the Dinky Town neighborhood of Minneapolis. Who the hell names a town Dinky Town, Larry? With her friend, and attempted to enter a local bar. She was denied entry by the bouncer because she was intoxicated. Shortly thereafter, Khalil and two other men approached GS and SL outside the bar, invited them to a party. Khalil then drove the group to a house in North Minneapolis, arriving in the early morning hours of May 14th, 2017. There was no party at the house. Duh. SL testified that after walking into the house, GS immediately laid down on the living room couch and soon fell asleep. JS testified that she blacked out due to intoxication shortly after arriving to the house and did not clearly remember lying down on the couch. JS woke up sometime later to find Khalil penetrating her. She said, "No, I don't want to," which he replied, "But you're so hot and you turn me on." JS then lost consciousness and woke up at some point between 7 and 8 a.m. with her shorts around her ankles. She retrieved SL from another room and the two called a lift and left the house. During the ride, JS told SL that she had been raped. Later that day, JS went to Regents Hospital in St. Paul to have a rape kit. However, there is not a crime. How is there not a crime here?
Well, we're not saying there's not a crime here. There was a crime here. Not even the court said that. What they said is that the law did not recognize voluntary intoxication as rendering a person mentally incapacitated. That's what they actually said. And it's important to point out right now that there was a less serious charge that the prosecution could have chosen, which would not have resulted in this outcome had they chosen that. The state chose to charge him with the more serious charge, which criminal, and they could have used the less serious charge, and unfortunately, they appear to be headed towards defeat on this, and that's what happens when you're not happy for a conviction. So, I guess you want to know why they didn't choose the other charge, right?
Yeah, definitely. Why didn't they do that?
Well, because it was only a gross misdemeanor rather than a felony.
Of course. Well, stop right there. Tell me about gross misdemeanor versus just misdemeanor.
I don't know. It's probably the high level misdemeanor. We call it a high misdemeanor here. Okay. So it's probably a high level. So, but for the first offense, for that, it would have been a misdemeanor. And that would not have satisfied the victim, nor would it have played well in the community. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why we actually have negotiated pleas. Had the state charged the proper offense, they probably would have gotten a guilty plea, which would have meant some level of accountability and I think registration as well. I think that's on the list. We can have one of our patrons from Minnesota tell us if we're wrong, but I think that's on the list. Unfortunately, some cases are just too political, which makes it impossible to offer a reasonable plea.
Okay. This is super gray area. I mean, I was having a conversation with someone about this yesterday. If she didn't consent to it, then, and he did it anyway, then like that, there's no gray area there. However, she put herself in the stupor that she did. So then does everything that happened to her from that point forward, because she put herself in the stupor, then she's just, like, everything else is not her, is not anybody else's fault. They could have robbed her. They could have done all kinds of things.
That's not what the court's saying here.
It sounds like the way that the law is written, because she is self-inflicted on the stupor, the drunken stupor, that it's not rape.
That's not what they're saying.
Okay. Then that would go why I'm still confused. She was intoxicated and the parties agree. What's the problem? You cannot have sex with an intoxicated person.
Well, the issue is that the statute required that the intoxicant be administered against her will. And the state did not assert, nor did the evidence show, that was the case, that it was without her agreement. There just simply wasn't any evidence to support that. Now on the other hand, the guy Khalil does not dispute that there's sufficient evidence on the record that he knew or had reason to know JS was under the influence of alcohol. The court's decision in this appeal is centered on whether the legislature's definition of mental incapacity includes a state of mental incapacitation caused by the consumption of alcohol, voluntarily or not, or whether it's limited to the circumstances where the state of mental incapacitation results from consumption of alcohol administered to the complainant involuntarily without her agreement, which is what the statute requires. This is what the statute requires the court to do. The court didn't write the statute that says that's what's required.
No, of course not. Of course not. I hadn't really ever considered how this would go down. Plus, I don't, even if there is a rape kit, you still have a he said, she said. So there's obvious, they didn't, in the docs here, I didn't see if there's, did the rape kit come back and say there had been activities going on?
Oh, well, they've already stipulated that there was sex.
Okay. So then you're just down to a he said, she said. He's saying she was ready to go, and she says, I didn't say that. But if her friend was there, Larry, and said, hey, this happened.
That's not an issue here.
Okay.
The issue is that the statute required that it be involuntarily administered to her. That's
right. So like
statute.
Date rape. Somebody spiked her drink, and that's how she became incapacitated.
Correct. Incapacitation is not recognized under this statute unless it was involuntarily. He didn't write the statute. The court didn't write the statute. The legislature did.
Yeah, of course, which is represented by the people. I'm with you. Okay, so you're always hell bent on reminding people about textualism is not necessarily good or bad. So is this an example of where textualism is a good thing?
Well, I don't know if I would say it's a good thing, but this is certainly an example of textualism. This is the purpose of statute. This is what the court said. The purpose of statutory interpretation is to ascertain and effectuate the intention of the legislature, and our deference to the intention of the legislature is due not only to Section 645.16 from the legislature itself, it also reflects a structural understanding that legislators or elected representatives of the people and the legislative bodies are institutionally better positioned than courts to sort out conflicting interests and information surrounding complex public policy issues. That's on page 9, between 9 and 10 of the opinion. If the legislature didn't intend to have that prohibition in there, that that incapacitation that was voluntarily administered didn't count as being incapacitated, they should have not put that in the law.
Correct.
So you don't like legislating from the bench, do you?
I don't think that they should, but of course there are times when we do want. Brenda has the same question that I was just coming up with. It says, do you think that the legislature will now go in and change the law?
I do believe they will, and I think that it won't take them very long. So
Will this wait till next year to go down the path? Are they still in session? Does this happen this year in some kind of emergency session? Okay.
I don't think they'd call it a special session for it, but if they're in session, this is certainly going to be introduced if it's not too late. They have to fix this. The victims' advocates will not let this go.
Yeah, sure. Is what the court did was to render textual interpretation and punt to the legislature? Is that, do you think that's a fair way to word it?
Well, I guess that's one way of looking at it. They did their job. They looked at the law and they applied the law unanimously. There was even not a single dissent in this decision.
Through the time of doing this podcast, I have come to the conclusion that I believe that we want them to be textualists. Of course, there are times when we don't. But if we were not competent, and I mean we as in the you, like literally like the lay people, and we don't go deal with our legislators, and we are not competent in who we vote for, and when there are, this is a lot of work, Larry, but these laws are really important in how they impact our lives, and we need the language to be hyper-specific about what they do and don't do. You had me watch a video yesterday and they were focusing on these like 1 and 2 and 3 words of how this bill was being written. And they matter in the outcome of things. And if this is not what we the people wanted the legislators to do, then we would want them to go change it. We don't want the judges to go behind them and go, well, no, this is probably not what they meant. We don't know what they meant. We know what they wrote.
That is correct, and courts typically do everything they can to discern the intent and to apply it as it's written, if possible. And sometimes they'll go beyond the written words, and they will contour a statute to they can drop a word from it to make it constitutional. But most courts are very hesitant to fix policy. This is as a self-governing people, you have the right to impose ridiculous policies on yourself.
Correct. Right.
That's a part of self-governance. If you want to do that and you're happy electing people who put you in a restrictive state of things that you don't like and you continue to elect them, that's on you, not the court. That's on you.
We can make jaywalking a felony and make people get executed for a felony jaywalking. We can do that.
I don't know if we could actually get that to pass, but you could make it a much more serious crime. And
yes,
and
I know
that's your prerogative to do that. And the court.
I'm making a super extreme example, though. I'm doing that on purpose because we could do that if we really, really wanted to. I know you're saying it would never pass, but if we really were hell bent on doing it and it could pass and make it through, we could make it that you jaywalk and you die. Does the state appeal or do the charges get dismissed? What happens?
Well, the state really can't appeal. This is highest tribunal in the state, so, and the charges do not get dismissed either. The case is remanded to the trial court, and the state will have to make a decision now if it can overcome the previous testimony that there was no. I mean, they can't overcome the previous testimony, but if they have to make a decision now if they want to offer this person a plea bargain. Because there's no way they're going to secure a conviction on this offense. The same evidence is going to play out the same way. You know, the statute says what it says. The highest tribunal in the state has ruled that that it was a voluntary intoxication. Therefore, she's not mentally incapacitated as required by law because it was not administered against her will. So they cannot prevail on this statute. So they're going to have to offer him a deal. And the deal is going to be time served, and he's going to go free. And that's going to drive the publicity in Minneapolis and Hennepin County is going to go off the chart bonkers about how a rapist is going free. And that will put immense pressure on the legislature to fix this if they have the ability to do it this session, because this is a travesty of justice.
Okay. Is anything else? God, this is, you come up with really interesting ones. I'd never considered that. The way that the language in this bill works is that if you did it to yourself, then sorry, like what happens to you is your fault.
Didn't say that. I wish you would quit saying that. They did not say that.
That's what it sounds like it is.
That. They said they couldn't convict him of this more serious charge that requires a different level of proof. I just got through telling you the charge that they could have convicted him of.
Right.
So I don't know how that goes scot-free. I don't know how you keep saying that.
Because that's what it said. That's what I thought, Larry. I'm still back to it's if she did it to herself.
It says that's equivalent to a premeditated first-degree murder and a non-premeditated murder. Yes, the person is dead. They're still just as dead.
Sure.
But the elements of the offense are different and the penalty is different. This offense that they charged him with is a more serious offense and required a different level of proof.
They had
an offense on the table that they could have used, but it wasn't glamorous and glitzy enough, and it wouldn't have played well. And they rolled the dice, and they steamrolled, and they got the jury instruction. We didn't go into all the nuances. They got the jury instruction the way they wanted it, which just the mere fact that she was intoxicated was enough. And that was not what the law said. The mere fact she was intoxicated was not enough to render her incapacitated under this particular statute. But that doesn't translate to there was no statute that held him accountable. There was. The state chose not to use it. They will use it now because that's all they have.
Right. Okay. I got you. Okay.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Before we jump, we wanted to acknowledge Charles in the state of Indiana. Indiana, excuse me.
Yes, Charles wrote us a nice letter, and we're not going to read it because it's nice, but it's very long. But he was sharing with us about the State versus Wallace case from back 15 years ago and about the unconstitutional. He was replying to the decision out of Wyoming, and he was suggesting that Wallace should be looked at. And Wallace, of course, is not binding in Wyoming. And the registration requirements were different. What was being challenged in Indiana is far different than what was being challenged in Wyoming. So just because one state Supreme Court finds one registration statute unconstitutional does not magically translate to another state's registry being unconstitutional, because the levels of disabilities or restraints are different. You could never win a disabilities or restraints challenge in Vermont. There are no disabilities or restraints imposed. So it'd be difficult for you to prevail on that component of the analysis. But we do appreciate the letter, because there are things that we sometimes don't know about, so it doesn't hurt to have it. But anyway, we are aware of that case.
What is the pipeline to get that kind? Do people just write to Narsal and miscellaneous others and post them on different blogs? Like, do you think that stuff? How often do you think that stuff gets missed?
Well, it doesn't get missed very often, but occasionally there may be something that we have overlooked that might be relevant. This case has been out for a long, long time, and it's cited all over the place, so we're aware of it.
I guess it's the benefit of having, 10 years? Wait, probably, 12 or something years for Narsal?
I can't even keep track of it.
But geez, man, you've been around since time began, practically. You were there when they invented sand. I guess are you ready to jump over to the other case?
Let's do it, because we're doing on time. Yeah, we're running short on time, so let's do it.
We're at 50. Why do you feel that this is worthy of the very premier FYP time?
Well, it's worthy of our time because it presents a real-time opportunity for us to draw the parallel of to Smith versus Doe to this decision that was just decided. Now, would you please recite the name of this decision for all of our people in prison who want to know what we're talking about?
All right. Well, this is the Supreme Court of the United States, Torres versus Madrid et al. Is that enough, or do you need me to go for more?
That is enough. Okay. So the reason why this is relevant, you can tell me. I think you have an idea, but what were you thinking after you read it?
Well, I mean, it was decided by summary judgment, so that we can go there first. Can you remind me of what the good, the bad, the ugly, and all that stuff is, summary judgment?
Yes, that's why I put it in here, because I want to do the parallel that to Smith versus Doe. People have so much anxiety about Smith versus Doe, and that the alarming and frightening high recidivism. So summary judgment is a vehicle to avoid going to trial, and it's appropriate when there are no facts in dispute, and one or both parties believe that they're entitled to a judgment as a matter of law. And in other words, there was, in summary judgment, there's no trial. You do your pleading. The party that's bringing the action does their brief. The other party responds with their brief, and then you do your reply and support. You do your depositions, and you do everything you can to develop your case. And you say, gee, we don't need to go to trial. This case, there's nothing here to decide. The facts are undisputed. Well, the pitfall of summary judgment is that sometimes there are issues that were in dispute, and when you have a decision where there are things where the court could have better developed in a trial, all the doubt goes in favor of the non-moving party. So in the case of Smith versus Doe, the challenger was the one who filed for summary judgment because he said, well, you know, we don't need to spend a lot of time on the court. I don't want to have to register. This is crystal clear. It's ex post facto. They've passed a law that they've applied to me. It didn't exist when I was convicted. End of discussion. And the state of Alaska said, well, not so fast. You know, it's a civil regulatory scheme. And we would argue that there are a frightening high level of recidivism among PFRs. And he turned around and said, so what? Say it all you want to. You just can't do this to me because it's an ex post facto. And so all the benefit of the doubt accrued to Alaska because their defense was never tested. There was no evidence taken. So the frightening high recidivism was a fact that was handed to the Supreme Court by the agreement of the parties, which is what makes this case relevant, because it's a case decided by summary judgment, which goes the opposite direction. So that's why I put it in here.
Okay, and I mean, we've covered that quite a bit lately with the Butts County thing. Of one of the things that would have been in dispute is that particular part of your property right of way? We needed experts and whatnot to go in and decide, is that actually right of way that the sheriff can go drop signs down? That was a fact that was in dispute, if I recall correctly.
That is one fact, and it may become, the way the case was briefed on appeal, it may turn out that that's less relevant. We'll have to wait and see. But yes, okay. That was, in my view, an important fact that was not developed.
Then moving into this case specifically, what are the issues here, and can you please clarify and connect those dots?
Well, let me just read from the opinion a little bit so people know what the case is about. And it happened in New Mexico. At dawn on June 15, 2014, four New Mexico State police officers arrived at an apartment complex in Albuquerque to execute an arrest warrant for a woman accused of white-collar crimes, but also suspected of having been involved in drug trafficking, murder, and other violent crimes. What happened next is hotly contested. And then I'm still reading. We recount the facts in light most favorable to petitioner Roxanne Torres because the court granted summary judgment below to officers Janice Madrid and Richard Williamson, the two respondents here. That's, you can find that on page one of the opinion. So again, remember, the lady that got shot, the police shot her when she did not stop for them. She said that she felt they were carjackers. Oh. She said that she did not identify them as being police officers, and she was fleeing for her safety. The police, of course, said they readily identified themselves, that anybody would have known they were police officers, and that she didn't stop, so they shot. Well, remember, since this was decided on summary judgment, the court has to assume that her version is the correct version. So the facts that the Supreme Court were handed in this case was that she did not know that they were police officers, and the attorneys on behalf of the officers gave the court those facts by moving for summary judgment. So they conceded and consented to that being a fact. So whether or not she knew there were cops is irrelevant.
Okay.
Because all inferences and benefits of the doubt are going to the non-moving party. She didn't want summary judgment. She wanted her case to go to trial. And it didn't go to trial at the officer's instigation because they said all the different things that it would take two podcasts to cover all the things they said in this case. but the point I was trying to connect the dots on is that the Supreme Court did not decide that the officers thought that they were carjackers. They didn't decide that. Officers Madrid and Williamson handed the court that fact. Okay. By moving for summary judgment. And if you'll look at it that way, that'll help you understand what happened in Alaska. The court didn't decide that recidivism was high. They merely accepted the fact that the challenging party, Doe, handed to them. He said, go ahead and give me a judgment as a matter of law. It doesn't matter what they're saying that their defenses might be, because you just can't do this. And the court said, well, no, actually, they can do this as long as it's done in a civil regulatory way and it doesn't impose any disabilities or restraints and blah, blah, blah. And they mentioned that fact. Now, I suppose they could have just not even cited that fact, but it was a fact established by our side. We gave the court that fact.
I'm thinking back to that time. If that Kennedy Mendoza Martinez, is that the disabilities and restraints? Is that where that comes from?
That's the seven factors from a 1963 case called Kennedy versus Mendoza Martinez.
Had we presented that side of the disabilities and restraints to that whole court process, this may not even be where it is today because of that. Just hypothetically, us presenting that side of evidence to bring it to trial and all that stuff.
Well, I don't know that I don't think there were enough disabilities or restraints. They did that test. There wasn't enough disabilities or restraints. They would have survived that test.
Correct. And I'm with you because there was no living restrictions. There was really like no internet really to speak of in 2003 or whatever. So yeah, like you just had to go visit the Popo annually and go get your picture and fingerprints or whatever. Whereas
you had to mail a form in. Yeah. So didn't have to do any of that stuff.
Yeah, because in Alaska, you could be 7,000 miles away from your local Popo.
That's correct.
you could live out there with a caribou, and it'd take you 7 days to get there. But and just to clarify one other thing, just to put a mark on it, they didn't say any registry is okay. They said that registry is okay.
That is correct. They said what was being challenged as it existed at that time did not impose disabilities or restraints. You guys can fixate on recidivism if you like. It's a fixation that will never win you a case, at least a significant case. Or you can fixate on the disabilities or restraints, which will win cases and have won several cases. And that's what we have to do. Is we have to develop these cases below with factual evidence, expert witnesses, show the disabilities or restraints, and what the consequences are. And we distinguish ourselves from previous decisions, as we've reviewed on this podcast several times. We've shown where that the challenging parties have done a good job of distinguishing the registry as it exists now against the registries as it exists the last time they were decided. I think we just talked about that last week or the week before. You know, it's your job to challenge, and it's your job to prove. The presumption is that the registry is constitutional until you prove it isn't.
It seems, Larry, that most of the states, like sans, we'll leave out the super benign ones, but that the disabilities and restraints are, it seems that they're easily presentable. I don't know that you can get a case going and all that, but people can't get jobs, people can't find housing, the whole homeless camps that go on in Florida, and whatnot, those are clearly disabilities and restraints. How are they not seen that way?
Well, first of all, the your criminal record, they always argue that your criminal record is what causes you not to be able to get a job. They dispute that the registry is the cause of you not getting. So you're going to have to bring in evidence that shows that they would have hired you with your particular criminal conviction, but for you're listed on the sexual offender registry. Excuse me, the sexual offense registry.
Not offender.
That. Yeah, because they register the offenses. So when you get out of prison, remember, you're going to go in and register your offenses. But you have to prove that. The state will argue vehemently that you're not getting a job because of the historical fact of your sexual offense conviction. And where is your counter argument? What do you have to show that? You're going to need some expertise. You're going to have some data. You're going to have to show that a segment of PFRs who are not listed are employed at a greater rate. And then you're going to have to get into some picking that apart to figure out if there's a generational difference in the people. If you've got a group of a cohort of PFRs that are in their 60s, well, they already have barriers to employment. And if you're comparing it to a bunch of PFRs who have convictions who were like, that were adjudicated juveniles or very young, and they got those, like in Michigan, they have that Homeless Youthful Trainee Act that goes up to like age 26 or something. If you compare the two cohorts, and you say, well, they're registered. The ones that are registered have all these higher rates of unemployment, blah blah blah. I'm going to come back and say, well, that's true. But people who are 60 years old have a higher rate of all these things anyway. So that's why you need expertise, and that's why you don't move for
ass of money.
That's why you don't move for summary judgment on these things. You go in with a big bankroll, and you develop. You imagine everything that the state can think of. And there's been enough litigation that you shouldn't have to be very creative to do the imagining, because they've already put forth these arguments over the years. So you look at every argument that they put up, everything that they claim, and you have expertise ready to shoot their arguments down. Remember, it's your job to prove. It's not the state's job to prove. They have the presumption that the legislative enactment is constitutional.
Okay. This is what we were just discussing. I forget where I guess it was the article, the letter that somebody wrote in, that they say they're innocent, but they have already been convicted. So they have the burden of proof to prove. We, on this side of the fence, now that we are the PFRs, we have the burden of proof to prove that these things are disabilities and restraints.
And that they offend the Constitution of either their state or of the United States. And again, on page 10 to 11 of the Supreme Court decision, they went through 400 years of what constituted, or whether this was the issue in this case is whether or not they actually seized the person. And the cops argued that shooting, that since they never had control of the person, she was able to drive away after being shot. They said that they never actually seized her. And the 5-3 majority, Coney Barrett didn't participate because she wasn't on the court when this case was was originally heard. But it was 5-3 decision. And they said that at the time the shot was fired, that was a seizure, and they went through 400 years of jurisprudence from around the world, and English common law and blah blah blah. We had spent a lot of time, but they said in concluding again, applying these principles, articulated above, to the facts viewed in the light most favorable to Torres, the officer shooting. The officer shooting applied physical force to her body and objectively manifested an intent to restrain her from driving away. We therefore conclude that the officer seized Torres for that instant, and the instant the bullet struck her. So, again,
that's bizarre.
You hear them twice telling you that construing the facts most favorable to Torres. Because she didn't ask for summary judgment. She wanted to have her day in court. Now, she's going to get her day in court now because the Supreme Court didn't decide this on the merits. They don't find facts. So now the case is going to go back to federal court. And I can tell you one thing they'll do. They'll settle now. She's magically going to get an offer for some money, because when you shoot someone in the back and the Supreme Court says that your theory of that she was not seized is not a good theory, there's a good chance that they're going to start talking to her about a settlement.
Interesting. So can you clarify, because I'm confused. I'm the one that's dumb. They shot her. Did that constitute them seizing her or not seizing her?
The Supreme Court said it did.
That's bizarre. That's what I thought.
The five justices, there were three liberal pointy heads, and joined by Justice Roberts and Justice Kavanaugh. The three dissenters were, of course, the usual conservatives. This time, I was surprised that I would have thought that this would have been something that Gorsuch would have been sympathetic to. But as I realized, it came out of the Tenth Circuit, and he served there. He may not wanted to embarrass his colleagues. So since his vote wouldn't have changed the outcome, it still would have been. It would have.
That would have been. That would have been 4-4.
Yeah. So that would have upheld the lower court decision. But he didn't vote with the majority. But I continue to believe that Roberts will continue to be a moderating force on this court. Yeah. And I've said that over and over again. And when people say that all our life is, we know it's going to come to end because, you know, they're going to throw out Roe versus Wade and blah, blah, I don't see that happening. I think Roberts, being the institutional guy he is and the even cool head that he is, I think he's going to exert that influence over the court. And I think we're going to get much more moderate decisions than what we would have gotten had Roberts not been there. You know, if he's the best of all choices to be the Chief Justice in the current environment of what you have on the conservative side to choose from. So Roberts is going to be what saves that court.
That doesn't mean, though, that the court has not drifted radically right, at least in like the last decade or so.
Of course it has. Absolutely. But I'm saying Roberts is saving it much further
off the cliff. I'm with you on that. And I've heard plenty of politics podcasts that have talked about something along those lines, that he is going to be that middle-ish of the road, even though it's still probably fairly right. But I'm really struggling, and we can close after we just talk about this for a second. How is it that shooting you is a taking of some kind? I don't get that is actually them doing that, by them shooting you.
Well, like I say, the five brighter people than you and I are came to the
no
conclusion
kidding.
going through 400 years of legal precedent, and they said that's what it was. Now, you don't want to question the court's judgment here, do you?
Absolutely, I want to question them, because I don't see how that. I see that they shot and they attempted, I guess, and then you could perhaps have like resisting arrest if you then run away after being shot. But I don't get that one is. Anyway, I just wanted to talk about that just for another minute, because that's bizarre to me.
Seizure.
That's the word I couldn't remember.
The conservatives were very infuriated, and their dissent was very blistering. I did a half skim read of that, and they were not happy at all.
Interesting. Very bizarre. Before we close down, I want to make sure that I offer up a reminder that we will not be here next week. I'm going out of town and you're going out of town, and it will be very challenging to record a podcast next week. So you guys get a Saturday night off.
Well, I may not go out of town, but I'm glad to have the week off, because I'm so far behind with work that this will give me a chance to do some stuff.
Very well. Very well. Is there anything else before we close things down?
Well, I'm hoping that we can grow our podcast transcript. We're not getting any new subscriptions lately, so as you told people, please pass them around, promote the podcast. You're not going to get a better source, a more frequent source of information than these transcripts flowing into your prison.
Definitely that. What was I going to? Oh, do you want to, and like, do we want to try and make that goal about me doing a certain thing that we talked about last week if we hit 100 patrons? Do we want to like spill those beans?
Absolutely. We've got a challenge that if we get 100 patrons, that we're going to have the best saxophone performance from Andy.
Everyone in chat is screaming yes.
He is going to outdo Kenny G.
Oh my! No, I'm not going to go there. But Bakersfield, is that the name of the song? Bakerstown, Bakersfield. I forgot the name of the song.
Baker Street.
Baker Jerry Street. Rafferty. That's what it was.
Actually, it's okay. Gary, not Jerry. Gary Rafferty.
In another lifetime, I was a professional musician, and I still have some saxophones laying around. So if we reach 100 patrons, you can go to patreon.com/registrymatters and figure out how many patrons we have. And when we reach 100, I will do some crazy sax solo to this song. I'll do like a version of karaoke and play that song and play the sax solo for you people.
Well, you're gonna do the solo that's on the Baker Street. You're gonna do that?
I thought that's what we agreed to. I don't want to do all of the hooting and hollering and the dancing stuff from the St. Elmo's Fire one or whatever that was.
Well, I'd like to see you doing the bobbing that he was doing playing that sax.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll figure out what to do when we get closer to that mark. So there you go. 100 patrons. It's somewhere around the 20-something mark that we need. And then I will perform a saxophone solo live on stream and who knows whatever else happens to it. How about that?
Oh, yes.
Y'all in? So share and spread the word.
And we're actually contemplating doing a YouTube live or taking calls and stuff maybe once every month or two or something on a regular basis so that we can interact with our
people,
with our patrons and our audience. Yep.
Well, fantastic. Larry, as always, I think it is fantastic that you join me every week. I try really hard to find someone else, but you are always available and I really greatly appreciate it.
That is why I am here.
Just real quick, registrymatters.co is the website, 747-227-4477, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And as I already said, patreon.com/registrymatters. But with that, Larry, you are the best. I appreciate it. And we'll talk to you soon.
Good night.
Bye.
You've been listening to FYP.